Right. So welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to me. I am here again. This is Greg Bossen, and you are listening to WRFG 89.3 FM Atlanta. Welcome to Alternative Perspectives. This is Atlanta's only local radio hour devoted exclusively to issues affecting Atlanta's queer community. I'm your host, Greg Bossen, in case you missed it the first time. and thank you so much for listening. The opinions expressed here are those of myself and my guest and do not necessarily represent the views of WRFG, its employees, board, volunteers, funders, or listeners. Tonight's show, and I've been wanting to do something like this for a while, and I just happened to run across something online, and this gentleman was very gracious enough to come on the show. He's listening right now, so don't talk about him. His name's Matthew. But anyway, tonight's show is on conversion therapy. Now, conversion therapy is actually a pseudo-scientific practice of trying to change an individual's sexual orientation from homosexual or bisexual to heterosexual using psychological or spiritual interventions. Now, there is no reliable evidence that sexual orientation can be changed, and medical bodies warn that conversion therapy practices are ineffective and potentially harmful. Medical, scientific, and government organizations in the United States and the UK have expressed concern over the validity, efficacy, and ethics of conversion therapy, yet somehow it still exists. On tonight's show, we have a guest who has been through conversion therapy himself, and spoiler alert, it didn't work. He's still gay, and has devoted his adult life to making this awful form of therapy illegal. His name is Matthew Shurka, and we will be talking to Matthew in just a minute. But before we do that, we have our normal blobbity 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 blah.
News of the queer.
I know that's right.
Oh, no, she didn't say what?
All right. So I'm going to start locally for news of the queer. And this one is kind of a sad goodbye, but I know she's ready for it. She's been an amazing person in the LGBTQ community here in Atlanta over the last Lord knows how many years, probably 30 years. Her name is Linda Ellis. And Linda has stepped down as executive director of the Health Initiative and the Rush Center, capping a long career at the center of all things LGBTQ. And that is the Rush Center. If you're not aware of the Rush Center, it's an amazing space that's on DeKalb Avenue near Decatur. Maybe it's considered in Decatur. I'm not sure. It might be Candler Park. But anyway, there are all kinds of nonprofit organizations, including the Health Initiative, including Equality Project, including Atlanta Pride. There's just a bunch of nonprofits that are LGBTQ that call the Rush Center their home. So the Rush Center board announced Linda's departure, because she was head of the Rush Center, on Friday, and her resignation was actually effective November 30th. The center said it's searching for an interim executive director and is also seeking applicants to fill several spots on the organization's board. Ellis expressed thanks to supporters and colleagues. So Linda, and this was, you know, her own decision, and she's a wonderful, wonderful person. If I could, I'd see her as a therapist, but I know her too well. I think I've seen every other therapist in Atlanta, so she might be the last one. But all right, enough of that. I love you, Linda, if you're listening. Okay, now this happened last week in D.C. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services launched a national program on Tuesday to help provide free PrEP for uninsured people to prevent the spread of HIV. So for those of you that don't know this, PrEP is a pill that you can take that reduces your ability of contracting HIV by 90, as much as little as 92 and as much as 99%. And this is pretty amazing that the Department of Health and Human Services has launched this national program. Free PrEP program is part of the federal Ending the Epidemic Initiative announced by President Trump. And this is something good he's doing. So Hey, got to be happy about it. He announced this in February. The goal is to end HIV/AIDS by 2030. Four metro Atlanta counties, Cobb, Fulton, DeKalb, and Gwinnett, are among the 48 counties in the United States targeted by the initiative. PrEP is the use of a once-a-day pill taken by HIV-negative people to reduce the risk of infection by up to 92%, according to the CDC. To qualify for the free PrEP program, you must be HIV-negative, you must not have any prescription drug coverage, and have a valid prescription for the medication. The program does not pay for the doctor visits or the lab tests. So if you want to find out about how you can get PrEP for free, go to the website getyourprep.com, or you can call 855-447-8410. That number again, 855-447-8410. So I think that is awesome. I hate that you can hear me turning the pages. All right. So this happened in Atlanta, but it's actually a national issue. The battle over access for transgender students to school restrooms that match their gender identity has reached a federal court in Atlanta on Thursday of last week, with one attorney bemoaning the profoundly damaging discrimination faced by trans students. A panel of three judges from the 11th Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals heard arguments in the case of a gentleman by the name of Drew Adams, who's a trans boy. So this is a case that started in Florida. The trans boy, again, his name is Drew Adams, and he was denied entry into a boys' restroom. He sued the school county board in Florida in 2017, alleging that it violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and violated Title IX. And the court in Florida ruled in Adams' favor in July of 2018. So then the school board has appealed to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and that's what happened, and this happened last Thursday. So we don't know what the result is, but we'll see what happens there. So we'll keep following it. It's hard to say how they're going to decide, but something happening right here in Atlanta that's going to have profound effects, because the 11th District Court, Court of Appeals, that covers, I don't know how many states, Georgia being one of them. All right, and then let's see if we have anything else here that I wanted to talk about. I don't think I do. I think I am. Oh, yeah, one thing. This is just for fun. I like this. So, anti-mob prosecutor Nicola Gratteri. She's an anti-mob prosecutor. So she's an attorney that prosecutes mobsters. She told the Times that this is a crime syndicate in southern Italy called Ndrangheta or something like that. Ndrangheta, whatever. But anyway, it's a crime syndicate, a mob crime syndicate in southern Italy, now welcomes gay members. The news comes as a shock to anyone familiar with the Italian mob, which has long fostered homophobic attitudes. It undermines the image of themselves as tough, virile guys, Gratteri says, but the mafia has evolved along with society. Gays are now accepted, even as foot soldiers, as long as they don't parade it in public. So, according to Gratteri, gay men in the mob can now openly attend gay bars, have boyfriends, exchange passionate love letters, and even perform as a drag queen. In the case of Lady Godiva, Godiva is the son of a prominent mafioso. So, I don't know what to say about that, but I don't know whether to be happy or not, but hey. What are you going to do? So with that, we will be right back with our guest tonight on conversion therapy. And so with that, we will be right back.
Now heads to the upper house of parliament, where it's expected to pass.
Greetings, WRFG listener supporters. It's the end of the year, and WRFG wants to be your choice for an end-of-the-year tax-deductible love donation. Take a little time to go to WRFG.org to make your secure contribution. You can also send a check, money order, or even hand deliver your financial gift to WRFG at 1083 Austin Avenue Northeast, Atlanta, Georgia, 30307. We thank you for thinking of us and for keeping us on the air as your independent source for empowering information and listening pleasure. Hurry, make your tax-deductible donation while you still can.
For the best in local, regional, national, and international blues, as well as different styles and interpretations of the blues, tune in to the Blues Therapy Show and Dance each and every Wednesday morning, 8 till 10 a.m. with Stagger Lee.
Right, and we are back. For those of you that are just joining us, you are listening to Alternative Perspectives on WRFG Atlanta 89.3 FM. Alternative Perspectives is Atlanta's only radio hour devoted exclusively to issues affecting the queer community. So tonight's show is on conversion therapy. And so conversion therapy, for those of you that weren't listening a minute ago, it's a pseudo-scientific practice of trying to change an individual's sexual orientation from homosexual or bisexual to heterosexual through using psychological or spiritual interventions. There's no evidence that sexual orientation can be changed. We know this. Yet somehow people are still trying to do it. And I looked, this is really kind of shocking what they used to do. So techniques for conversion therapy this has been going on for a while. And in the United States and Western Europe, now they don't do this anymore, hopefully, but in the past, techniques for conversion therapy included ice pick lobotomies, chemical castration with hormonal treatment, aversive treatments such as the application of electric shock to the hands or genitals, nausea-inducing drugs administered simultaneously with a presentation of homoerotic stimuli, and this last one, masturbatory reconditioning. I'm not quite sure what that means. But anyway, that hopefully is gone. I have a feeling that continued through probably past the 1950s. But I don't think that kind of stuff is happening. More recently, the clinical techniques are used in the United States, and they've been limited to counseling, visualization, social skills training, psychoanalytic therapy, and spiritual interventions such as prayer and group supportive and pressure. Tonight we have a very special guest, Matthew Shirka, who went through conversion therapy starting at 2004 at the age of 16 and remained in therapy in one form or another for the next 5 years. And I want to, first of all, make sure that Matthew is on the air and can hear us. So, Matthew, are you there?
Hi, yes.
And you sound really good. Okay, great. So, let me just finish this. I'm going to brag about you for a little bit because going through conversion therapy, that can be a horrific thing. And we're going to let Matthew tell his story. And I'm sure a number of people that have gone through conversion therapy have thought about and maybe even committed suicide. But this did not happen with Matthew, who has something inside of him that pushed him forward. And I believe it was in 2012, or it might be the next year, but formed a project through a partnership with the National Center for Lesbian Rights. Matthew began a campaign called Born Perfect, which is a campaign to end conversion therapy. To date, Born Perfect has successfully helped pass legislation to end conversion therapy, making it illegal in 18 states and more than 50 cities in the remaining states around the country. They're even doing things internationally now. And so we're going to talk with Matthew. So, Matthew, welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for that.
No problem. And again, spoiler alert, He's still gay. Okay, so it didn't work. He's still gay.
Yes, I am still gay.
How gay are you on a scale of 1 to 100, would you say? You know, there's some people are, you know, they go one way or the other, but...
I mean, there's so much irony to that, because in conversion therapy, you know, it's like, how gay are you that you need fixing? And then, like, you know, then how gay am I now, really?
Oh, that is a question.
I'm pretty homosexual, you know?
Oh, yeah. So, oh, but are you saying that is a question in conversion therapy? Like, how gay are you?
Yeah, I mean, they won't word it that way, but they have different ways. You know, how far into the gay lifestyle are you? And the further in, and I can give examples of what that means to them, the harder it is to undo your homosexuality. So, yeah, no, that is so real. I know you were being cute as a joke, but that's real. And I guess a lot of people don't realize when these therapists or religious leaders try to attempt that, you know, they're really trying to undo something that they think they can.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because when I asked that question, Matthew, how gay are you? I was thinking about how attracted to men are you versus women? Because, you know, I believe sexual attraction is kind of exists on a spectrum. And for me, I'm all the way over on the gay side. Like, but you're telling me, I think what you're telling me is what they look at is what's happening. And I guess some questions they would ask to determine how gay are you, which means for them, how into the lifestyle are you? That would be like, are you going to bars? Have you had sex with anybody? Are you looking online? What kind of music do you like, perhaps? What kind of clothing do you wear? Am I hitting this or not?
I know, yeah. I would say it's all of the above. I guess from a pure attraction point of view, they want to know how much sexual experience have you had. And that's why a lot of conversion therapists, you know, their target audience are adolescents, teenagers. You know, when someone's going through puberty and discovering their sexuality, and how much experimentation have I had or someone else have with the same sex will determine, I guess, how difficult of a job it is for them to undo, so-called, their same-sex attraction.
Well, I think it depends upon how good the sex is.
Yeah, that too.
Well, you're just not trying hard enough then, you know. Well, I'm sorry I interrupted. Did you have a finishing thought or?
No, I was going to say, if you wanted just to start off, like, what, just to be clear about what conversion therapy is for our audience.
Definitely.
To clarify, you know, conversion therapy itself is not an actual therapy. It's not something that's taught in any curriculum at any university or college in the country. It is denounced by every medical and mental health association in the country, and it is purely something that has been created or made up by a small group of individuals that have actually had an impact just because of our religious and cultural backgrounds in this country. But I don't want anyone to be confused by the word therapy in the term conversion therapy. Conversion therapy has just, you know, become the coined term as an umbrella term to describe this attempt of undoing someone's homosexuality or gender identity.
Oh, gender identity as well. Yes, I was wondering about that.
You know, trans individuals or non-binary people are included, and many therapists or religious leaders of any kind will try to attempt to undo someone's trans identity. And that's why I include the gender identity or gender expression.
Gotcha. Well, let's start at the beginning. If you could just real quickly give me and the listeners kind of a story of, you know, where were you born? Did you grow up in a two-parent home? You know, that kind of a thing, just to kind of get the lay of the land.
Yeah, so I grew up in the suburbs of New York City, just outside of New York City. I'm like 30 minutes from Midtown.
Mm-hmm.
To give you like how of a liberal city I grew up in. But despite that, I grew up in a conservative town. I was raised in a Jewish household with my mother and father. We were more culturally Jewish than religiously Jewish, but the town itself was a conservative town. And yeah, I came out to my father at 16 years of age.
Before we do that real quick, what about coming out to yourself? Like, how, just real quick, give me an idea of when you discovered that.
My mother's American and my father has a Middle Eastern background. He's Israeli Iranian Jewish, and there's a machismo macho attitude about, you know, I guess a male dominant role at home, maybe more than other cultures or not. And also my father was a businessman. You know, the roles of mother and father were really clear, and who the breadwinner of the house was really clear, and had a real impact. So in my own coming out, funny enough, I actually thought some of the bonding I had with men, I didn't even recognize it as something gay or as my attraction to other men. I thought in like a, it was like a, just a bonding of the boys kind of thing. And I would even go skinny dipping or, cause I was on the swim team, and small little things would happen with other boys in my middle school years that I never actually gave a lot of weight to.
Right.
As I went from my 7th grade to 8th grade to 9th grade, high school, that's when I got, I think it really scared me, because I saw how the senior boys looked at the freshman girls, and I had my eyes on the senior boys. and it made me realize, as funny as that is, it scared me, because I understood that this was not just some bonding experience or one night experimentation or something friendly. I had a real attraction that you know, as real as it gets, and I could not identify with my heterosexual peers about how they talked about girls. So by the time I was a high school student, I guess with those, you know, those conversations in the mirror of understanding who I really am, and that the willingness to even just admit to myself that I just may be a gay man, and that's something I'm going to have to face.
Yeah, and I guess you felt comfortable enough to be able to tell your father about it. It's interesting you told your father before your mother.
Yes and no. My father is definitely the harder, more difficult parent to tell. I had a great relationship with my mother. I'm very close to her still. And I'll talk about my parents before and after conversion therapy. But I got beat up in high school, not for being gay, more just about popularity between boys. I guess what I did was, in knowing that I'm a gay man, before even starting conversion therapy, one of my ways I dealt with that was to fit in, but also stand out. And I stood out by being one of those boys in high school that threw the parties at my parents' house, you know, behind my parents' back, without them ever knowing.
Gotcha.
And that was a way of, like I said, fitting in and also standing out. So, you know, I thought that was my smart way of no one ever thinking I might be gay. Hopefully that girls would like me, or the popular kids would like me. Anything that would just sort of like not have anyone think about that I myself might be gay. And so as my parties were great, and I was good at that, and it did make me more popular in school, and I purposely avoided a group of boys in the grade above me, and because they were bullies, and for whatever reason, they saw me as a younger kid in their school, becoming more popular, and they beat me up one Friday morning after school, pretty severely. I was hospitalized because of it.
Oh my gosh!
And this is my same fear. You know, they had a reputation of beating up other kids at school. And so it was after, you know, 2-3 months later of my broken nose healing and the stitches on my face coming off, I really came out to my father seeking his security. I wanted to know that my father was going to take care of me as his gay son and not only just as his son. And so it felt important to approach him because I felt as much as I loved my mother and felt close to her, I needed protection, and I felt that my father was the one to give that, not my mother.
Makes sense. So what was his initial reaction?
So he was great. I was terrified. I cried, you know, your classic coming out story. And he told me that he loved me no matter what. I think he was taken aback from it, but he made it clear that he stood by my side. And, you know, we might have actually, I think, became really close in that moment. And it was, you know, that conversation itself was great. And it was the next day where everything changed.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So the conversation itself went really well. And I know this now, but he had like a family meeting without my knowledge, meaning with my mother and my two sisters, about what to do about this. And so he felt that there was a problem and he needed to help me, whatever that meant. You know, I think that's him thinking about what does it mean to have a gay son? What does that mean for our family? What does that mean for my future? And so he began in the weeks ahead talking to different therapists, you know, licensed professionals in the New York City area about my coming out.
This was in 2004, correct?
This was 2004 in New York, yeah.
All right.
And he met one licensed professional who explained to my father that there is no such thing as homosexuality and that all people are born innately heterosexual, and that anything LGBTQ is stemmed from childhood traumas that have never been dealt with. And is so from a male's point of view, from a cisgender male's point of view, if I had a childhood trauma that was untreated, then makes me feel less than my male peers. I seek out gay sex as a way to overcome my insecurities and feeling less than. And it's like an ongoing psychological cycle that the only way I can come out of is if I just treat the trauma that happened. So now this theory sounds really realistic, I think, to any parent who's seeking support and is being told that, you know, you don't have to have a gay child. You can have your child can be straight the way they're supposed to be.
Right.
And that's what my father was told.
Well, and certainly you could make the argument that, you know, in a way he was doing it out of love because it's probably, you know, from his standpoint, and it's probably true, it's a little harder to be gay than to be straight in our culture. So you could argue that he, you know, he was doing it out of love. But anyway, so you started going to this therapist. So this is what I really want the listeners to get to kind of understand what that experience was like. And I know you went to a number of them, but maybe we'll start with the first one and then we'll just grow from there. So tell me about your initial experiences with this.
Yeah. So I just mentioned about the part about my parents being this out of love, which is true. And it's something I'll discuss maybe after, right, in terms of how I reconnected with my parents and the role that parents play when they send their children to conversion therapists. A lot of parents do believe they're helping their children. And so, yeah, I'll touch upon that.
Sure.
So my first therapist was short-lived. It was only about 2 or 3 months. It was in Manhattan. I say short-lived only because I didn't like him.
Gotcha.
He was a much older gentleman. I was going once a week after school, taking the train into Manhattan and doing my therapy sessions. And was all things were according to that theory, you know, looking into my past and understanding why and how I became gay.
Gotcha.
It was the next therapist who my father found, because I complained about this one, that really was the bulk, I would say, of a lot of the harm I went through. And that individual I was with for 3 years, just him. Just for the listeners to know, my experience was 5 years total with 4 different therapists. And in between that time, I also went to 1 conversion therapy camp. And so this second therapist I saw in that timeline was the one who really began the training of undoing my homosexuality. And so first thing they saw was, you know, how gay are you, as you said. And because I had not had sex with another male yet, they saw my case as very easy and even told my father that I should start to see my heterosexuality come back within as early as 6 weeks. And,
wow,
you know, that was a big, you know, that made my dad very happy. And so I'll continue. And, you know, we tried to look at what are the causes in my own life. And fortunately, I had a really great upbringing. There's not really anything drastic or traumatic I could say my parents really did. But what they did see was I was the youngest of three kids. I have two older sisters, very close to my mother, and they immediately sort of diagnosed me as having too many female role models and that my relationship to my mother and father was unhealthy. And so I was instructed to spend as much time with my male peers as much as possible. So father, uncle, boys at school. As you can see, this made me very happy, especially with the boys at school. And simultaneously spending as little time as possible with the females. And they did that they wanted me to understand that my female peers were not the ones I should be relating to as my friends. They wanted females to be seen as the opposite sex, the sex I will engage with and a woman I'll marry one day. And, you know, the mysterious opposite sex, as Freud would say.
Right, the other, those people over there that you don't really connect with or interact with very well until you get older, I guess.
Yeah, and so...
Does that include your mother and your sisters?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And so what was so harmful is that this instruction was taken so seriously by my father and by my therapist, I wasn't allowed to speak to my mother and my two sisters for 3 years total. And so this had an enormous impact on my life. Let me back up, actually.
Sure, take your time. This is horrible to hear. I'm thinking your mother must have been a wreck about it, but go ahead.
Well, my mother did not know at first. You know, it was the relationship was really between my dad and my dad and the therapist. My mother was treated as the other, like she didn't know any better. And my mother gave her blessing to my father at first, knowing that we had spoken to a licensed professional. And my parents were just both really naive about this treatment. And really, you know, my parents did their due diligence by wanting a licensed professional rather than just a religious leader. So, you know, I thought in the months after starting those instructions of males and females, I actually thought conversion therapy was working. I was getting along with all the guys at school. I thought I was becoming closer to them. I genuinely believed I was changing. I followed the instructions. Women seemed to be more interested in me because I was just ignoring every girl at school. I really thought it was working. And as time went on, I would have these moments where I would mess up, where, you know, I'd experiment with one of the boys I knew who also might be gay, and I would go back and tell my therapist every detail. And the attitude my therapist had was, you know, okay, one step back, two steps forward, was their attitude about all of it.
Right. And this is from age 16 to 19, when your hormones are going crazy. And I just want to back up real quick. I hate to interrupt, but I just want to make sure I understand. You're saying you never spoke to your mother and your sisters. Now, they were in the house. I know your mother. Are you literally saying that you walk around the house and don't speak to your mother?
Yeah. So with my sisters, it was easy because they were both older, and one was in college at NYU, and the other one was also living in the city. But yeah, my mother would never agree to separate us physically. And so what that looked like was me waking up in the morning, my mom would make me breakfast, I'd walk downstairs, have breakfast, and I would leave without saying a word to her. And she was devastated, and as this went on, she began to fight with my father, and she understood what the therapy was doing. My parents' relationship began to break down. because my mother would say, you know, there's no therapy in the world where the solution is separating the mother from its child.
You got that right.
Because of his sexuality. And,
oh my gosh. But so you...
You know, my mom, you know, yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, there was many moments where my mom would try and speak to me and say, you know, if you're gay, that's okay, I would accept you. And I would throw a tantrum right back at her, you know, even curse at her, how dare you? For me, it was really a matter of life or death. It's how hard the time and effort I put into this therapy. And so I really viewed her, as my therapist described, as the person who was causing my homosexual problem.
Right. And then here she is telling you that it's okay. So she's interfering.
Exactly.
But anyway, so you would mess up occasionally, and then you would admit and two steps forward, one step back. It's almost like treating it like an addiction, you know, where, you know, you do fall, but you get up again and you keep going. But I'm just curious, because this is an age when, I mean, I don't know, I was masturbating, you know, 2-3 times a day. I mean, are you still, when you were you still masturbating at night and thinking of boys, and just kind of what was going on there?
Yeah, of course I was masturbating as a teenager. And
were you thinking of boys or looking at pictures of boys?
That was talked about in my therapy to start with, about how I was using that pornography. And so I would always try to watch straight pornography. And of course, I was always more interested in the boys in the picture than the girls.
Gotcha.
And, you know, this is something that my therapist would openly discuss. They really believe, you know, if you're going to masturbate pornography, then try to associate my orgasm to the female imagery over the male imagery.
Right. Like, you could get yourself almost to orgasm, and then right before you orgasm, maybe you look at the woman for a second as you're orgasming to try and retrain your mind. I could see something like that.
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, and I really believed it, and I would do those things. But it seems like, you know, watching straight porn is really just a cheat. There's still a male, and there's something to be excited about when you're that age.
Right. All right. Well, I think at this moment, it just feels like we should take a break, because this has been pretty intense for me. So for those of you that are listening, this is Alternative Perspectives, WRFG Atlanta 89.3. And I'm Greg Boston, your host. We're talking with Matt Shurka about his experience undergoing conversion therapy and his current campaign, Born Perfect, whose mission it is to end this damaging practice worldwide. So with that, we will be back shortly. So just hold on one second.
My time was running wild.
First time in 19.
And now a message from the Public Affairs Bulletin Board.
The Atlanta Regional Kwanzaa Association, formerly MECA, Metro Atlanta Kwanzaa Association, presents Kwanzaa in Atlanta 2019-20. Community Kwanzaa Expo, Sunday, December 22nd, noon to 8 p.m. Thursday and Friday, Umoja and Kuji Chagulia. Saturday and Sunday, Nia and Kaumba. Kwanzaa count for children ages 5 to 12 from 10 a.m. to noon. Also, Umoja celebration Thursday, December 26th from 4 to 9 p.m. Ujima celebration Saturday, December 28th, 5 to 9 p.m. Nia celebration Monday, December 30th from 5 to 9 p.m. to be held at the Arts Exchange Community Center, 2148 Noonan Street, East Point, Georgia. Family-friendly edutainment, African Marketplace, Karamu, candle lighting ceremony, and keynote speakers. The website is artsexchange.org, and the number is 404-624-4211. For information on other Kwanzaa festivities and events, the Kwanzaa hotline number is 404-594-2607.
Every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me. I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Changes. Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Don't wanna be a richer man.
All right, and we are back. For those of you that are just joining us, you are listening to WRFG Atlanta 89.3 FM. This is Atlanta's only queer radio hour. It's at Alternative Perspectives, and we are speaking with Matt Shurka about his experience undergoing conversion therapy and how he dealt with it. So, Matt, you still there? Matt, you there?
I'm here.
Okay, good, great. So that was David Bowie. That was Changes, because I wanted to have a song about change, you know. So I had to let that play until it said change. But really, we don't want to change, and the only thing we want to do is to learn how to be ourselves more, you know, which is really what it's about. But they were trying to change you. So before the break, excuse me, you were discussing how the therapy worked with this second therapist, and that went on for three some odd years. And I guess you can just continue with the story. So you thought things were going well. So then what happened after that?
Well, you know, as time went on, and as much as I can keep telling myself and fooling myself that this was working, I knew that my attraction for men or the same sex was only getting stronger. I was going through my puberty. I was becoming more of a man. I'm turning now 20 and 21 years old. And that's really where the depression, the suicidal thoughts and suicidality really starts to consume my mind, is because I know that I'm not changing. And the between my father and my community, the therapist and everything I'm being taught, you know, and at that point, I'm dating women. I have sexual relationships with women. I'm doing everything by the book these therapists had explained to me, and I knew that I was not changing. And so, and I'll just add to that, there was never really a moment where I put the blame on the therapist, you know, that maybe they were just guiding me or they were wrong. Not for the very end, but the blame, and I see this with many survivors, or most survivors, is that because I'm being guided by a person I trust, especially a person who is a professional, the blame was always on myself. Was I not trying hard enough? Did I do this right? Maybe I can't change, you know? And, you know, they told me 6 weeks in the beginning I should start to see changes, and instead, here I am 5 years later, and I'm more attracted to men than ever before.
Were you still being honest to these therapists years later, or had you kind of gone in the closet with the therapist too? Like, oh, I'm not really having problems anymore, when inside you were.
No, I was honest with the therapist. I really, you know, because I started at 16, I think it would have been really different if I was 17, 18, or 19. But as a 16-year-old, I really believed that the therapist had their best interest at heart for me. And I, you know, I trusted them. I trusted them that they were going to take care of me. So I didn't see a reason to hide or lie. I really believed they had the answer to overcome my homosexuality. And I was doing all that because they set out how horrible my life would be if I was an openly gay man and the impact it would have. So for me, becoming straight was a matter of life or death.
Right. So what did they say when you would tell them after all this time? What is their response when, you know, this has taken so long? I'm sure you felt hopeless about it. What would they say? Just how would they deal with that, these therapists?
Well, therapists would change. My therapist would change over time. I saw four different therapists total. Three out of the four therapists themselves were ex-gay men, meaning they themselves had overcome their same-sex attraction. But they just never gave up. It was, as I became older, I began to question them and challenge them more. The thing that made me leave conversion therapy was me wanting to meet successful patients that they've had who actually overcome their homosexuality.
And they couldn't provide you with any?
Yes. So I would meet all, they would introduce me to men who were married with kids. And, you know, this would be their example. And I would sit down with these gentlemen, and every conversation would go the same. Which is that, you know, how hard they worked to do this, but they all admitted that despite them marrying a woman and having kids, that their same-sex attraction never went away. And it was something you just had to work on for the rest of your life. And for me, that was like, that was the biggest reveal that this doesn't work.
And wow.
That, you know, they're treating it like it's maybe another form of a drug addiction or an alcoholism. But the fact that all these men were admitting that they're dealing with their same-sex attraction decades later, that gave me the greatest confidence to walk away. I didn't come out of the closet immediately, but it gave me the strongest confidence to walk away from the therapy at 21 years old. And also, by the time I was 21, I was estranged from my parents. I wasn't speaking to my mom because that was a part of the treatment. And I became this very angry, resentful 20-something-year-old against my father. And I had cut him out of my life at that time also.
And where are you? Are you in college? Where are you when you're doing this? Senior year? I'm trying to remember what 21 is.
By the time I'm in and out of college at this point.
Yeah, probably having a tough time. Yeah.
Yeah, I actually, to date, I have not finished college, and I walked away, you know, saying I'm not going to finish, just because of the amount of anxiety and pain I was going through being a conversion therapy patient. I've gone to like an emergency room maybe 6 or 7 times as a conversion therapy patient, having an extreme panic attack where I just have like nurses and doctors just calm me down, you know, trying to convince me I'm not having a heart attack.
Wow. So you made this decision, and based on these, you know, amongst other things, talking to people who are telling you, nope, still attracted to guys after all these years. So then how did that lead? How does that lead to what you're doing now? Because what you're doing now is quite amazing. But we'll just do a little teaser, you know, to tell everybody that you are actively involved in attempting to make conversion therapy illegal, and have had a lot of success since you started doing this, I guess in 2012 maybe is when you started?
Yeah.
So tell me, first of all, how did you, that's a big shift. So what happened after you accepted this? A big weight off your shoulder? Like what were you feeling?
Yeah. So I left conversion therapy in 2009. I came out of the closet as a gay man in 2012. And then it was late in 2012, I did a YouTube video for the It Gets Better project. And for those of you who don't know, that's a nonprofit for anti-LGBTQ teenage bullying. And I was bullied, but not, you know, I made a video, it's like a 4-minute video saying whether someone's trying to bully you or change who you are, you know, the message is that it gets better and that, you know, whatever tough situation you're in, that you'll be able to get out of it and really try to prevent suicide. So I did that video, it's 4 minutes. And that video, before even getting uploaded to the website of the It Gets Better project, it went viral online. And it it was on my local news. It made a few major news websites. I guess it was on the cover page of the Huffington Post in 2012, and it said Matthew Shurka gives emotional testimony about his time in conversion therapy and makes its way around the blogosphere world. That was the title. And so it went really far, and you know, I had no intention of that ever happening. And so my story came out. I was very public at that point, you know, all within the same year of me being open and owning who I am as a gay man. And besides the media from NBC Nightline and Dr. Oz and other people who reached out to me, there were two organizations that reached out, and that was the Southern Poverty Law Center and the National Center for Lesbian Rights. And both groups are legal organizations. And specifically, Southern Poverty Law Center was working on a lawsuit regarding conversion therapy, which I ended up helping them on. But it was the National Center for Lesbian Rights who had just spearheaded the legal side of making conversion therapy illegal. And so they were just getting ready for they were just wrapping up their first law, which was making it illegal in California, and they had asked me to join their efforts in supporting them as a survivor of conversion therapy. And so in 2012, we began working together. And for those of you who don't know National Center for Lesbian Rights, also known as NCLR, they are a legal organization, been around for 40-some-odd years now, and they work on all legal issues that are LGBT-related. They're not just a lesbian group. And so I worked with them just with their legal reputation of what they've accomplished and the fact that they were the ones who were going to take this on. And from there, in 2014, we created Born Perfect, which is a campaign, which I now oversee, created by the National Center for Lesbian Rights, to outlaw and end conversion therapy. And since we started, conversion therapy is now illegal in 18 states and over 60 U.S. cities. And all of that was done with our model legislation and all the elected officials we work with around the country.
That's just amazing. Now, I'm assuming that Georgia is not one of those 18 states, which is where we are here in Atlanta.
No, it is not, but it is. We have a bill that was, we had a hearing in 2019. It was more symbolic, but we are getting ready for a piece of legislation in Georgia for 2020, and Georgia is one of our states that could possibly add its name to that list. So that's the good news about Georgia.
Well, if you can't do Georgia, you could certainly do Atlanta, I would think. But how do you...
Yes.
Yeah. How do you do that? You just pick, say, you know what, let's go for this state, and you send somebody down there? Or I guess you'd need to find a legislator that you know is going to be friendly and start there. Maybe that's how you start. I don't know.
There's a number of ways. Of course, you need an elected official who's interested. Sometimes we'll reach out to an elected official, or that elected official will reach out to us. But there's also certain states that we're asking elected officials not to pass a bill yet, because maybe the climate in that state is not ready for it.
Right.
Sometimes we'll see a conservative introduce their own bill as a reaction against us, and that's a more difficult situation for us to be in. That has happened a few times. So, you know, I would say one of the best things about working with Born Perfect and the National Center for Lesbian Rights is the bipartisanship. You know, if you look at, and most people don't realize this, but if you look at the 18 states that we've passed these laws in, 7 of the governors that signed these laws into law are Republican. And we are doing everything we can to not make this a partisan issue, despite everything that's happening politically in our country. And we're actually bridging the gap between conservative families who don't understand what it means to be LGBTQ. And now with the Trump administration there, ending conversion therapy has become the only cause in the entire LGBT movement now in 2019 that actually has progress.
Right.
Because of the Trump administration, every single issue has either paused or gone backwards. Trans military, employment is not moving forward. It's sort of like, you know, since marriage equality, there has really been nothing moving, and we've been able to have conversion therapy move forward And it's really the patience of working with those individuals who may not fully understand what it means to be LGBTQ, but start the conversation.
Well, and this might sound pessimistic, but you know, if you're a conservative Republican, but you're trying to say, you know, I don't hate gay people, you know, I'm not good with the marriage thing, I'm not interested in protecting their rights at work, but this is something that I'll do. Maybe that's why you've been able to get some push for it. So, well, we're out of time here, but two things. First of all, I just want to thank you for coming on the show, but I want to thank you as a gay man, and I want to thank you so much for what you're doing in the community around the country. And if people are interested in finding out more about it, and you can just go to your website, which is just bornperfect.org, and you can find out all about it. I'm assuming they can make a donation there if they'd like to. And then I guess the last thing I'll say is, how cool is this, Matthew? The hell that you went through, and you have flipped this and turned it into something that is so empowering for you personally, I'm sure. I mean, it's really amazing.
Yeah. it's been a journey and a roller coaster, and it's hard to even still sometimes fathom how we got here, or how I got here.
Yeah, well, it sounds like there was
that means a lot.
Divine intervention. But so we got to go here. Thank you so much for coming on the show and for listening. And I guess that's it then. Keep on working, buddy. I'll talk to you later.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right. And thank you so much for listening. And next up, we have What the Folk. So this is not their music. This is my music. All right. Till next week.